Welcome to this podcast called Lyttelos, or Listener's Pilot in English. My name is Annabelle Guaita and I'm a classical pianist. At the moment I'm sitting here in a flat in Berlin with my colleague and friend Janice Wong, who is a multisensory researcher. And we did a show yesterday night in Berlin with piano and wine tasting. We're going to talk more about that later, but we also invited Janice's friend and colleague, Chris Lloyd. You're a pianist, and you have also been doing cross-modalism for some years. So welcome to you both. It's really nice to have you here. I'm curious on how this is going to develop. Would you like to say something about yourself, Janice, just to introduce
Sure.
your work?
Thank you, Annabelle, for having us on your podcast episode. And it's, you know, in these times of, you know, recently past COVID, it's really nice to be able to sit together physically to record a podcast. So, like Annabelle said, my name is Janice Wing. I'm an associate professor of food science at the University of Copenhagen. And Annabelle and I did a show last night in Berlin where we combined music and wine tasting to help educate people on what these two different experiences have in common and how the experience in one can actually help us more understand the experience in the other. So I have been doing this kind of multisensory research and also multisensory performances since about 2014, 2015. And this is also when I met Chris here in London, and we used to do quite a few installations and performances. So I wanted to also invite Chris to join us today so that we can have a chat about the different ways we have used multisensory research in kind of artistic performances or workshops.
That would be exciting. So Chris, could you just say a few words about yourself? Why are you here in Berlin? Because you're Australian, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I moved to Berlin at the beginning of 2017 from London. And mostly that was to do with bureaucracy and visa reasons and the desire to stay in a culturally active space in Europe. And so when I moved here, it was still the cross-modalism dream was going really strongly. And then in 2018, I pivoted towards a new project, which is the 1781 Collective. The goal has been the same throughout, though. I'm a classical pianist, trained in Adelaide in Australia, and then moved to London to the Royal Academy of Music. And whilst I was studying there, I sort of realised that whilst classical music is a really fantastic, phenomenal thing, I had no interest in engaging with the classical music industry and the sort of philosophies and mindsets that sort of inherent within that. And so I thought, well, I'd still want to keep playing the music, and I just need to find my own audience and develop the new ways of listening to engage with people. And so that set on a 10-year journey, which I'm still on. And originally with Janice and with all the very strange...
Creative
in inverted commas, crazy probably better, events we used to do. They're still essentially going on and getting a little bit more mature as the years go, but I'm sure we'll talk a lot about those different methods and discoveries.
I heard you play yesterday. I was into your webpage and I listened to Scriabin's fourth sonata.
I can't remember. Is it any good?
I liked it.
Thank you.
I experienced it as quite a full of silence. You have, I know this sonata from before, and I noticed that you were appreciating this a bit slow and contemplative.
I mean, the beginning of that, I'm trying to remember the fourth. I played the fourth. The last time I played the fourth was in a techno festival. That's the one.
That beautiful chord.
Oh, so gorgeous. Oh. And it leaves so many questions, that first chord. It's only bettered by the first chord in Tristan. But yeah, no, the last time I played that was in front of like 1,000 people on a whole lot of psychedelic drugs at a techno festival. And it was, yeah, that's a good audience.
But Janice, when you had doing a study some years ago where you actually analyzed how people would describe chords, different chords. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yes, so in that study, I was still doing my PhD in Oxford at the time. So I actually wanted to kind of invert my research direction, because at the time I was studying how listening to different sounds or different music can change the way we taste food. But I had an idea one day, well, what if we study how the tasting experience changes the way we listen to music? And being an experimental psychologist, when we design a study, we always have to break down what we're trying to study into very small, digestible parts. So it would be quite difficult if we wanted to measure, you know, how people reacted to a 5-minute piece of music. So instead, I thought one easier way is to just take chords. We had 3 or 4 note chords of different levels of consonants and dissonance. And I think I had about 15 or 20 of them. And I would play the chord, and then I would ask people how much they liked it or disliked it. Mm-hmm. So actually, it was a liking example. But the trick is, half the time, people listened to these chords and rated them while they were eating a piece of sweet candy in their mouth. Mm-hmm. So they had this very, you know, sweet-influenced mindset, we can say. And then the other half of the time, they listened to all the chords when they were eating a piece of very sour candy. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in how this taste experience would really change the way we think about and feel music. And again, the reason why I asked people about liking and disliking for the chords, it sounds very simple, but I had, let's say, quote-unquote, normal participants who were not trained in music theory, so I couldn't ask more sophisticated questions.
Question from the audience. In a scientific context, how do you deal with the subjectivity of, first of all, you put it into like and dislike, and then from a... So that is instantly framing it from a subjective point of view. And then obviously sour and sweet is another subjective thing, because some people, weird people, like eating lemons. So they like that, where most people don't. And then you've got the music, which again is a third layer of subjectivity. So how does that filter into your creative, scientific research?
Well, in the end, what I am measuring is subjectivity in a way. I want to study how people's liking for the interaction between taste and music would change if you change one of the factors, which is taste. So you can argue that it's building on liking plus liking or disliking plus disliking. And one of the things we have to also measure is if you give... We also gave people the taste by itself and asked them how much they like the taste. So that's one way to start, because it's possible that you have people who, you know, like sour tastes, and maybe they also like dissonant chords. And if you put the two together, it's a great and wonderful experience. And that's the kind of thing that we can take away to put into artistic practice.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit more about that chord. Let's listen to it again. And I mean, as a musician, I would have my ways of describing this chord. And maybe if you have like this vocabulary of eating or tasting, it will be different. Listen to it. Or in the music it comes like... For me, this is a chord with... It's like opening with a question. So it's very open. It can go anywhere. That's my feeling of this. That's how I would describe it. It's dissonant, but yet very pleasant. How would you describe it?
I think I use this a lot. I teach with my students that we use so many different language tools to try and define and inspire our musical decisions. And I think when we're trained, we're both pianists. We are trained quite often to use imagery and colour. And so that's the first thing that comes to me. So the colour would be, and I'm not claiming synesthesia as much as just associating something, which it would be like a light blue fairly transparent, with a dash of pink on top, and that's the questioning element. So I'm associating that, and I'm thinking a little bit cold as well. We're thinking temperature. When you play Ravel up the top, it's always very icy. When you play the first chords of Wagner's Tannhäuser, it's like a brown, woody warmth. Mm. And I think these are all things that help us as musicians identify the quality of the sound. Because again, if we want to go deep into musician territory, we can all admit that the piano is essentially a soulless tool. Like, it doesn't have a heart of its own. It's all very superficial. And I think Charles Rosen said in his book Piano Notes that the only thing you can actually do, everything is a lie, or everything is imagination, because the only thing a piano can do is you press the note and a hammer activates a string. So everything else on top is this layer of imagination, and we use that for ourselves, and then we can also use that to communicate to an audience, because we hear that chord again and you go, oh yeah, light blue with a tinge of pink, that sounds nice. Oh, there's a question also. And therefore, so we're just adding that extra layer of worded communication to the more abstract sound of it. And then the use of imagery as well. If I said, having learned that piece, I remember the left hand is the descending chromatic line is representative of female lust, and the ascending fourth is masculine lust. So we can start talking about this interplay of sexuality and sensuality within that one chord that starts it all off. And again, it's just another way to take whatever that chord is, a half diminished augmented seventh or whatever it happens to be.
That's interesting. Thank you, Chris. You're talking more about the experience of the chord than mm-hmm. the actually definition theoretically, which opens up our own imagination when we hear this kind of approach. I like it a lot. I think in music education, we should use more the language of experience, connecting it to theory. So like phenomenological, so not the very subjective. Of course, there's also always an element of subjectivity when we talk about colors or... But the fact that we also approach the experience by using words like open or closest, words which is a bit neutral, that's very interesting. So more of that into music education, I would think, would be good. So you, Janice, will you want to hear the chord again?
Yes,
let's
please.
Give it a try.
Green apples, Janice. Think of green apples.
So if I were to put on my kind of food and beverage hat and think about how that reflects more eating experiences, I really like what Chris said earlier about it being cold. Because Annabelle, we had also worked with temperature concepts in some of our previous workshops. The chord is very crunchy, if I can say that. There's like an... Yes, I can see the open question. There's also, for me, it's a little bit sad or like wistful. There's something that's missing. Mm. But if I were to describe it with a food experience, I'd say there's... It's almost like the green banana you had yesterday. There's a little bit of like an unresolved astringency in the chord. Mm. And if I had to describe a flavor, right, it's not sweet. There's some sourness there. And I can see why Chris said the green apple. It's like there's something not quite ready to be eaten, whether it's a green apple or a green banana. And there's a bit of astringency, but you eat it and somehow it makes you want to eat more. Just like with the chord, you listen. And there's a bit of tension, right? You want to keep on listening. It's not resolved.
Yeah.
So it kind of builds up this suspension.
Mm.
So
yeah, sorry.
I was just going to add, I think musically, we can, like, from an objective theoretical point of view, we say, yeah, that's exactly what's happening. The third of the chord is missing. That's the bit that craves satisfaction. And plus, it's a dissonant chord that By definition, it's like the stretch rubber band that is the tension that keeps growing, and you want to keep eating to get that release. Like it's almost a dopamine kick of the resolution of the harmony. So I think like what you're describing there is purely subjective. Everything we've said is like our own experiences, and then can be backed up by the sort of intellectual theoretical element, which is cool.
Yeah.
Mm. And exploring vocabulary for experience is never wrong. I mean, in these days, we just need more vocabulary for our experiences. And then looking into taste and temperature is amazing. I mean, that was what fascinated me when we met 4 years ago, Janice. We were thrown into a project by a common friend, and when we started to talk about the music that I was playing at that time, I was playing Ravel, and you started to talk about cold sounds. I was like, no, this is not cold, this is warm. But then I realized you actually meant physically
the temperature.
Cold, the temperature. Yeah. And I had never thought in this way at all. And working now these years with exploring music together with you has opened my ears in a much wider range, and also the words to describe the experience, it's like opening up a room. It's like inviting the musical experience into the room of words or the language that we have as well. Yet it's never the actual experience. The actual experience of this music is a world of its own. The words can only lead us to the experience. That's my. We're talking about that yesterday with the audience. That it's like Wittgenstein's ladder, that the ladder is just the tool to get up to the experience. But once you are in the experience, you just have to throw the ladder away behind you.
So to add on that, right, I come with a different perspective, which is a lot of what I do is teach people wine tasting.
Yeah.
And I think that wine tasting maybe has quite in common with classical music listening, which is people tend to think that there's one right way of describing these experiences and that only experts have the right words to describe, whether it's classical music or wine. And what a lot of my research is about, actually, is to kind of open the doors of description to maybe people should not be so closed-minded and think that there's only one right, correct set of words. So I work a lot with using metaphor to describe wine. So I often will tell people, taste the wine, and then describe the person. If this wine were a person, what kind of person would it be? And I use this as an ice-breaking exercise to kind of get people to maybe look behind just chasing the different fruits in the wine, but more think about the emotion, the personality, how does it make them feel, to try to get to the experience. And I think working with you, Annabelle, is very interesting because we're both working on how do we open people's minds.
Yeah.
About being more free to use different sensory modalities or different experience or different aspect of your life to try to describe and shape these experiences.
I describe this piano as an old lady with loose teeth because all the keys were very loose and they were completely unpredictable. So if I wanted a soft sound, there was a loud sound coming. And if I wanted a loud sound, the key didn't respond at all. So it was like completely hazardous to play.
But, you know, I was laughing when you gave that example because in a very few words, you described the piano so well and I could understand exactly what you were talking about.
Mm.
And I think this is the beauty of metaphor, is that regardless of what area of expertise we might have, sometimes we can all draw on common human experiences, like describing an old lady with loose teeth, and we can actually communicate really well different scenarios or phenomena just by drawing on these common human experiences that we all understand. Yeah. So that was a really nice example.
Hmm.
Thanks, Annabelle. So I spent a lot of my research career looking at taste and sound interactions. And at first people might think, well, but sound and taste have nothing in common, right? What's the point of doing this? So if we take a step back, the fundamental understanding here is that humans receive sensory input about the world through all of our senses, from what we see and what we hear, what we smell, taste, and touch. And we kind of combine these streams of information in our brains to form a picture of the world. So when we are walking around, kind of experiencing real world, we don't really think about, you know, which stream of information came from sight and which came from hearing. They all just kind of integrate together in the head. And that integration process is actually very interesting. And that's what I spent a lot of my time studying. And a consequence of this multisensory integration is that people tend to form associations between different sensory attributes. So a very basic example is if you think about a low sound and a high sound, people tend to associate a low sound with a large object and a high sound with a small object. And this association we find in adults, in children, even in infants. So it's a very, you can say, inborn association between size and pitch. And there's an evolutionary reason for why we might have this association. It's because in the wild, if you hear an animal make a very high pitch noise, you can make the assumption that the animal is small. Therefore, it's probably safe. On the other hand, if you hear a very low-pitched animal noise, that is probably a very large animal, and maybe you should consider being extra careful or running away. So this, you know, pitch and size association actually has a evolutionary theory behind why that should happen. But not all types of associations work like this. Another example could be how we associate colors with different tastes. So not everybody, but most people, say in the Western world, will associate red color with sweetness and green color with sourness. And this is because growing up, we can see a lot of candies are designed this way. Mm-hmm. So that the green candies or the green juice is usually like lime or lemon. It's very sour. Whereas the red color will be, say, strawberry or raspberry, something more sweet. But the funny thing is, with this color and taste, we see different associations with different cultures. So, for example, a light blue color, the study has actually been done. So if you show people a drink with a light blue color in the US, people will say, oh, it's blue raspberry, because people are used to this fictional raspberry flavor. But if you show the same drink to people in Taiwan, they'll think it's mint flavored, because their association is more with mouthwash.
Interesting.
So we have these also, some are evolutionary inborn and some are more culturally developed associations.
Yeah, so is this research interesting for example, the food industry?
It's very interesting for the food industry, because we always make expectations and predictions about what the food might taste like. Before we eat it. Again, from an evolutionary standpoint, it's very dangerous to put things in the mouth. Because when you swallow, either it will give you nutrition or it might possibly kill you. So you can imagine that the mouth is the last line of defense. That's why we use all of our senses to try to make predictions about the nutritional value of the food before we swallow. And that's why the eyes are very important. What the food sounds like could be important. For example, last night with the temperature, you hear the sizzling, you know it's hot.
Mm. Also, we were eating in the Korean restaurant exactly. After the concert, yes.
And smell is also important, because that's, you know, outside the body. And that's why food marketing relies on packaging. So to bring up, round it up from a commercial perspective. You know, the color of the packaging, the weight of the packaging, the material, how does it feel? So food companies spend a lot of time and energy to think about how to convey information about the taste of the food before you have to eat it or buy it.
Yeah. Thank you. That was informative.
You're welcome. Hello, everyone. So in this segment of this podcast, we're going to do a fun experimental session. Chris has been volunteered to be an improvisation guinea pig. So now we're going to explore the association between different flavors and sound. I will not call this music, I'll call it sound. So Chris, no pressure. And how this is going to work is that we have a plate here of there's some cheese and cake and chocolates and crackers. And Chris is sitting in front of the piano with a blindfold on. And the reason why we put the blindfold on him is one, he doesn't know what I'm going to feed him. And two, this way he's not biased by the color of the food. So it will really, the music he plays or the sound that he will make on the piano will really be reflecting the flavor. And by flavor, I mean also the texture, the taste, and the smell. So it'll be combined. So Chris, are you ready to start?
Fantastic. The description sounded a little bit kinky, but we are in Berlin, so...
Makes it more fun. All right, so I have the first piece of food. So Chris, open up. And whenever you're ready, you can play your improvisation. And it can be as long as you like. So listening to that improvisation, I almost feel like I was tasting the food. So now my question for you is, what were your reasoning behind the improvisation?
The first sensation was a combination of the flavor and the texture. So I'm going to assume that was the marble cake.
Mm-hmm.
And the flavor is that sort of warm brown sugar sort of typical cake, but the texture is super airy and fluffy, and not quite fresh, like not just out of the oven, you know, it's been sitting out for a while. And so there's a fluffiness and a machine-made sort of factory-produced fluffiness as well, rather than this was your grandmother who made the perfect cake.
And how did you express that texture in the music?
I felt that was the light fluffiness was getting up in the top ranges of the treble clef, whilst the flavour seemed to be, the inspiration I had for that was more the lower chords, and there's this sort of warmth and sort of fullness of the different things. Like I was thinking cluster chords because it wasn't like, you know, one sort of sweet third or something like this. It was more like, oh, there's lots of different things going on.
It's more complex.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when you were playing and you ended on that major chord, which I thought was, did it have a sweet finish?
Well, no, it was just like at the end of the day, it's a nice piece of cake. I think it does what it's supposed to do. I'm assuming that's one of the sort of typical cakes that you buy at a grocery store in a package, and that's been manufactured by food science to leave you satisfied, and a major chord leaves you satisfied.
I thought that was amazing. So
I'm surprised I found it with a blindfold. That was pretty cool.
So I want to add another playful element in our second exercise, since I have also Annabelle here. So Chris, Actually, I would like both of you to close your eyes, because I will give Chris a piece of food. Chris, I want you to play the music. And then Annabelle, I will ask you, what is the food that Chris ate? And see if you can make that association. Does that make sense?
That's cool.
So both pianists, please close your eyes. And Chris, please open your mouth. Here we go. Very cool. So Annabelle, if I can ask you to come sit next to me. So before I ask Chris to explain his rationale behind the music, I want to ask you, Annabelle, based on the music, what do you think was the food that Chris ate?
Well, it was not so easy to say, because I know what's on the plate. I shouldn't be watching the plate now.
Well,
to see what's gone.
But actually, I should say, this is actually how we usually do research studies.
Yeah.
We have people listen to a piece of music, and then we usually give them a fixed multiple choice. So you're actually doing something that I might do in a study.
Well, what I heard is it started off quite soft. So I was thinking, okay, this is something sweet. It's melting in my mouth. And then after a while, there was some stingy moments that I thought, what can this be? So then I thought maybe it was this wasabi cheese that we bought yesterday. But then it just kind of came back to this more soothing, melodic harmonies. And I haven't tasted this wasabi cheese yet, so I don't really know how it tastes. I'm just making an assumption that wasabi is quite stingy. So instead of going for the chocolate, oh, I see you have only 3 chocolates there. I think I put 3. It's very hard, I mean. I think I go for the wasabi cheese. I also heard the way Chris was chewing. it gave me like a cheesy feeling.
So, well then.
Okay.
Yes, that was the wasabi cheese.
Oh, can I try it?
Yes, please. I haven't tried either. I'm curious. So, Chris, please explain your... Because I heard the stingy... I thought that note was perfect to describe the piquancy.
And when I'm eating the cheese now, I notice that in the beginning it's soft. And after a while, the wasabi comes like ding. Strange.
And I think that's really to explain the flavor experience there. Janice tells you it's wasabi cheese. It looks toxic green when you see it on the plate, and you think to yourself, "Oh dear." And so then the first experience that came through when I realized it was that as opposed to a chocolate was tastes like a cheddar. Oh, that's not too bad. And then personally, I love spicy food of all different types, so I was expecting more wasabi, and it never really came. It's this sort of soft undertone afterwards, and at the end of the day, I'd say I'd probably associate that specific cheese without the colour inference, which is interesting, because it is a toxic green look. I'd associate that as a cheddar with a hint of wasabi rather than the wasabi being overpowering, and hence it sort of ended on this perfect fifth flavorless note, because you know cheddar is boring. So I sort of wanted to do that, and what I'm finding interesting is that this improv is beginning to it comes out as more of this sort of linear storytelling aspect rather than a direct flavour to sound thing. That's just how I'm improvising it as it comes out.
Yeah, because I think it's really cool that you're actually reflecting your chewing in real time almost towards the end. Or because I see this development, right? At first it was gentle, and then the spicy kick comes out and it develops really beautiful. We should just do a concert series of this and have the audience guess what food you're eating.
That would sell very averagely, yes.
Right, so shall we try the third piece of food? Annabelle, I'm going to ask you to hold this. So Chris, are you ready?
Ready and willing.
All right, here we go. Open your mouth. So I have a question for you. I mean, what was very clear is the rhythmic, the crunchy, but I was wondering if you were also trying to depict the taste.
To an extent, but then limited by the blindfold nature of finding actual consonant chords. So I'd say, I wanted to say there was less dissonance. And for me, the thing that came out was rhythm. Rhythm seemed to be the best way to represent what's essentially a bland cookie, but it's got also, it hasn't got chocolate sprinkles or anything. It's just the sort of sweet, what we call butterkeks, butter biscuit. The texture is the main element that seems to come across. Well, the flavour is nice, sort of sweet with a bit of warm creaminess from the butter, but then the texture, and then the funny aspect that came to me was the evolution of the texture when you focus on it. It starts off very crispy and dry, and then a little bit of too much information maybe, but then your saliva combines with it to make more of a sort of pleasant
mush,
and then by the end of it, you're sort of left feeling a bit dry as well. So you have this textural experience more interesting than the flavor experience, I'd say.
And I was wondering the tempo of the improvisation. I almost felt like you were trying to match the rhythm of your chewing. Was that true, or am I just...
Oh, I probably just started off that way, in that when you're listening to a piece of music, when you're going for a walk, you end up walking at the same tempo a lot of the time.
Yeah. And I was waiting for the moment when the crunchiness would turn to this more soft mush.
Maybe the musicians would be like, oh, he went from staccato to a little bit more elongated staccato.
I think I got that. Yeah. And the chords went from more full to like fewer chords. And I feel like that was a representation of how there were less food in the mouth as you started chewing.
Yep, pretty much it.
So that was really cool.
Cool.
So we have one last piece of food for you. I'm saving the best for last.
Oh.
Okay. It's open. Thank you. So just listening to the music, I felt like that was by far the most complex piece of the four that you played.
Mm-hmm. And definitely the most complex combination as well. Dark, bitter chocolate with these little crunchy bits and a gorgeous texture combination of you. You've got the chocolate shell, the fudge on the inside and the crispy bits within it. And just like that, because it seems to be quite dark chocolate, so you get that long, bitter aftertaste, which is still there. I reckon that low bass tremolo could go on for another 5 minutes or so at this rate.
That's amazing. So just for the listeners, one thing that Chris really beautifully demonstrated is he said that this bitter dark chocolate and the low bass note, and this is something that we find very often in research, is that people naturally tend to associate low pitch with bitterness. And actually, we know this exists, but we still don't know quite why that is. In fact, I have a research project underway right now where we're testing different theories of why people think that low pitch is bitter. So thank you so much, Chris, for playing with us in this experiment. I thought it was like a really amazing experience just to hear you improvise. So I hope that you also had fun.
Thank you for the chocolate.
Well, I'm amazed. I'm really amazed because not only by your playing out of one tasting experience, one piece of chocolate, it was a good quality chocolate. It was Nidaga, an Easter egg with fudge inside and small chocolate nibs. But I didn't know that. So when you started to playing, and I was thinking, does this little chocolate egg sound like this? I mean, this incredible development of this little musical passage. And then when you were speaking about what you actually ate, I discovered, okay, you're actually developing the piece as the taste were developing in your mouth. So it's a talk about development here. Amazing.
I think that's the sort of the... When we're playing piano, when we're playing classical music specifically over a long form work, storytelling is key. Storytelling is everything. Mm-hmm. We tell it to ourselves in real time. And I think if we can communicate that experience to the audience, like perhaps if someone else was playing and eating the same thing, they'd come up with a completely different sound. But at the same time, that would be compelling and we'd be convinced by that also. So, yeah, storytelling... alongside the sensory elements, I think that's what we love as humans, and that's what can help us connect with any type of person from around the world.
So, Annabelle and Chris, I, as an outsider, I'm not a classical musician. I was just wondering, because you're talking about attracting new audiences, but how do you define classical music? What exactly is it?
I'm not so happy about that term. I wish I could call the classical music in a different way, but I'm not so happy about the art music either, because that sounds a bit snobbish.
Oh my God. I mean, when you said art music, my head literally exploded, because then I'm thinking, okay, well, what is art?
Yeah.
A colleague of mine who's a Greek folk musician once defined classical music as Northern European folk music, so that could be the answer.
Oh.
I think it's one of those things where you know what it is, but you don't know what it is not, perhaps. As in, you hear Beethoven and you don't think it's electronic music, you associate it as classical music. But when you hear Niels Frahm, you're sort of caught in the middle. Is it electronic? Is it classical? And then I think that's where these definitions become problematic, where then you have to make a stand and say, I like classical music or I do not. And I think that becomes really problematic.
That's already the problem, I think. I like to say that classical is something that transcends time. So it's music or art that is surviving time.
But what about, say, you know, I live in Denmark and you live in Norway. What about, you know, Nordic folk music? You know, I used to play Celtic music, which is from Northern Europe. But would you call that classical music? It has transcended time. You know, you have melodies from the 1500s.
Absolutely. And I really like the word folk music. If you expand that term a bit, I mean, then Beethoven is also folk music. It's music for the people. At least it used to be.
And so then maybe the definition that, or the explanation between the definitions is that classical music is simply overthought, a sort of really complex music that transcends time, as opposed to folk music, which is not. And again, that creates, an, for me, an unnecessary dichotomy where you have to say one is for smart and one is for not smart. Mm. And then you take away the examples of a combination of those different things. And actually that for me brings it back to the perceived issue of composers like Ludovico Einaudi and composers like Hanya Rani, where young people, by that I mean people under 40 perhaps, are really coming back to piano because there are composers who are playing music that resonates with them, that they like. And you've got classical musicians who say that doesn't count as classical music because it's not complex enough, or it's too repetitive. And as a result, we can't just say, is that good music or is it not? And again, perhaps another example of how our societies like to be binary and have right and wrong.
Yes. And maybe when we are curating concerts, we think traditionally, so this is either a jazz concert or it's a classical musical concert. And that is the problem itself, that we kind of predefine what you're going to hear. Mm-hmm. And I see here in Berlin, there's a lot of crossover events. They don't even call it concerts. It's more like...
I stopped playing concerts. I now do performances or experiences because that... the word concert, I think, is more limiting. Mm-hmm. So people have an idea already that a concert is at the Philharmonie, but a performance can be anything in any space.
That's interesting. Mm. Yeah. And I've actually stopped calling the audience. Mm-hmm. I like to call them participants.
Yes, nice.
It's more active.
It's mm-hmm. much more active. It's like in Norwegian, deltaga. Mm-hmm. So they take part because they're absolutely invited to take part in the listening experience. Without anybody listening, there is no music.
Very philosophical.
Well, I'm there listening when I play, but it's not enough, you know. Yeah. Music happens in our senses, the connection with our sensory.
So from what I've heard you guys talk so far, you think maybe in the future, classical music, however we define it, maybe one way to go forward is to be more inclusive and maybe do away with the more restrictive terms like concerts, and say we have performances with participants. And I should say, this is not true just for classical music. I think it should be for all sorts of music. It's about doing away with maybe words and definitions.
I think for me, this is really at the crux of it. I mentioned earlier that I've set my career outside of the traditional classical music industry. And I think one of the issues with the traditional classical music industry, we will call CMI now because that's a really long way to say it, is that they are consistently complaining that no one's interested, that audiences are dwindling and that people aren't coming. But they're really not changing their model at all. So they say, we want new young people to come to our concerts, but we want them to enjoy this in the way that our old people currently do. And then they don't understand why people don't want to do that. And I think for me, for the past 15 years, I had an experience where I realized that our content as a product, if I'm to start speaking in sort of commercial terms, the classical music itself is phenomenal. Like Ravel is objectively badass good. Like, it's incredible, but the context that it's being delivered cheapens the product and has lost interest to lots of people. That's not to say the traditional concert model is bad. I think I like it and it serves a lot of people, but it can't be the only way. And in the 21st century, we're witnessing an evolution of consumers, audiences, guest participants, where I think if we think of television,
in the 90s, when I was growing up, we had television channels, not cable, where we had to wait 1 week in between episodes, and it was dictated. Our consumption of entertainment was dictated by the programmers. And then we've shifted since then into streaming platforms, where the audience, the consumer, now dictates when they watch, how much they watch. And this has even, I think, reached a point of participation when Black Mirror released Bandersnatch, I think in 2018 or 19, which was a choose-your-own-adventure television program. And I think we see now, also across social media platforms, this evolution where individual human beings don't want to consume, but they want to create. And that's the rise of TikTok as the most, as the foremost sort of entertainment platform in the world now. Apparently for people under 25, TikTok is more popular than YouTube, than Netflix, and all streaming platforms combined. So what does that say, I think, about people now? They don't want to passively consume, they want to actively. And that's why I think you calling them participants rather than audience is phenomenal. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to develop performance contexts where people feel like they're contributing to it. And our challenge as artists and classical musicians is to deliver that in a way where the music is still relatively untouched, where Ravel can still speak. You know, we're not putting bells and whistles to try and make the product better. The content is good, but the context needs to be evolved.
Thank you. That's really nice open ideas here. But let's take it down. Let's say that you, Chris, you are invited to a symphony orchestra and you have a week and you're going to curate the concert. You can choose the music, but you can also choose the way it's presented. You can change anything. You have a kind of a good budget there in your hands. So how would this concert be?
And it's a full symphony orchestra?
Yeah.
In a typical hall like the Berlin Philharmonic?
Yeah. Or Bergen Philharmonic.
The Bergen Philharmonic? I'm going to assume that's even better than the Berlin Philharmonic.
We have actually the oldest symphony orchestra in Europe.
Hey, this is cool. Number one, I'd tell us if it's Bergen. I don't know anything about Bergen except that it's in the north of Norway, which means...
basically a west, yes.
It's pretty high up in the world.
Yeah.
And I imagine there's a lot of hidden history there, and I would tap into. So Berlin's a funny city, filled with expats and also with a lot of its own tradition. I'm thinking this association, the orchestra, is probably receiving a lot of money from taxpayers, and therefore they're already contributing to it. I want to start making a project that reflects on them. And the one thing that I know about Bergen's symphony orchestra is that it's the oldest in Europe. So now I'm trying to make a story that connects the heritage of this orchestra to the living heritage of the people within this town, and I want to make a concert that resonates with them. So the first thing we do is we'll probably take it outside of the concert hall and we put it in public. We crowdsource a series of repertoire. We also don't bring in a really famous soloist from overseas. We get someone from the orchestra to play at the front. Because you know what? That's the stupidest thing in classical music. You've got really good players. Why are you paying someone 10,000 euros to come and play in front of them? And so we start developing in 1 week an audience sort of sense of ownership over this large organization where they are invested in the product as well. So for such a large event, I don't think we can get people to do active participation as much in the sense like, are they going to be lying down? Are they going to be holding hands or things like this? But can we start to develop a story where the people from this town feel pride and feel a sense of belonging with this association that they're already supporting? And we do that somehow within 1 week. And we probably play a lot of Grieg.
Grieg is very popular in Bergen. I wonder why. So what you are talking about is making connection and breaking the rituals and making the music sound resonate with our own history.
I think that's it. I think I'm fascinated by the use of ritual historically. I think every society has developed them. I just got back from a week-long funeral for my grandmother, which was quite very beautiful because she's Chinese heritage but extremely Catholic. So we had two sets of rituals. We had daily masses and then 7 days of Buddhist respect paying as well. And so I'm looking at these people from all over Indonesia coming to pay respects, and we all combine over this ritual. And classical music has its rituals. We, from the moment of purchasing a ticket, we know what to wear, we know when to clap, we know when to arrive. But rituals can also be exclusive. So we need to develop rituals that allow people to feel like they belong. Again, this sense of community. Because you will support your community. You will not support your abstract enemy, though. So if we continue to insist on rituals without maybe teaching people those rituals, or without making those rituals more contemporary and accessible to newer people, I think the whole question of why don't people like classical music is so obvious why they don't feel connected. But we can use all these elements. We can use ritual, we can use community and a sense of belonging to unfortunately, the word relevance comes in to be more relevant in the 21st century.
Yeah. So the rituals around the classical symphony orchestra concert is a lot, if you think about it. I have had questions from the audience saying, why are people not clapping in these obvious clapping breaks? Meaning between the movements. It's a very good question because, I mean, in the old days, in Mozart's time, they could clap between the movements if they were feeling like it. Now it's become like when are we going to clap? When is it wrong? When is it right?
And this is a huge issue in the classical music industry where we prioritize the right etiquette over the audience expressing their enjoyment of something. And again, we wonder why people aren't interested.
Maybe making a clapping concert where it's like completely up to the audience when they feel like clapping.
I have experienced that. And what I, like a colleague when I was at university tried to have one of these concerts. And he put us in the audience to clap whenever we wanted. And even then it was so hard to break through the social training that we've received. It was really hard. So we tried something else instead. We said, where in 2019, we developed these concerts where people were not allowed to clap at all. So we took out the anxiety of when to clap. It became no longer a thing where people were sort of framing their experience about when was correct or not. They just knew there was no clapping. It wasn't allowed. So therefore, they didn't have to think of it. And when you're creating your program, you do need to then not finish on a Brahms trio where it's bump, 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 bump. You have to finish pianissimo. And the experience is phenomenal because people just feel comfortable in the silence. And if you've done a really phenomenal job in the performance, they start clapping at the end because they can't help it. And you know that clapping is genuine rather than forced etiquette.
Yeah.
So can I just add something when you were talking about clapping, because I used to go to the opera quite often, and I feel like in opera, when someone is singing a tremendous solo, the audience starts shouting, right? So there's an example of, you can say, classical music, where the audience is actually encouraged to have these spontaneous expressions. So I wonder what happened. Like, is there something about the human voice that makes it more natural for you to spontaneously say, bravo, that was great?
But I think in the opera world, the tradition of clapping between arias or after great performances of the singers has been kept, whilst in a symphony, the clapping between movements is seen as like a sin because you're breaking the holy unity of the four movements, you know.
And that's cognitive dissonance in itself. When you listen to the end of a first movement of any Brahms or Beethoven, this so clearly designed for applause afterwards, and historically we know that's the case. So these rituals are superficial and relatively new and have no basis in quality of experience design. So again, the CMI it doesn't beggar many questions as to why it's problematic, because nothing feels worse. I think I wrote an article once that compared not being able to clap after the first movement of Brahms' symphony is essentially like a ruined orgasm. Where you sit there, oh, oh.
So let's round this up with a little wine question.
Mm-hmm.
In Bergen, there has been an attempt to attract audience through inviting them to bring in wine in the concert halls, which has turned into a discussion whether this is good or bad. So some people feel it's very annoying because the sound of the glasses or the bottles...
The slurping maybe is distracting.
Yeah, it's distracting. And other people like to kind of relax with a glass of wine in their hand. Personally, I think it shows a signal that is a little bit counterproductive, because we don't want people to kind of get blurred in their senses when they hear music. We want them to experience the music in a clear and a very strong way. I don't know if wine is that way to go.
Well, I would flip the whole discussion the other way, which is wine purists insists that when you're tasting wine, it should be in a silent room, and white walls, no distractions whatsoever. But I have never ever seen a wine bar that is silent and clinical. Instead, I am often annoyed because I go to a wine bar and people are talking and it's loud and I feel like I can't focus on the wine, which should be the star. But wine bars are very popular because people go there to have a good time. And the wine is just one element that contributes to the experience. So I feel like that the modern concert hall is maybe like the ideal wine tasting space that is white and silent and all your attention is geared towards the music. But I would argue that if all wine bars were silent and white, you would have people who are not going to wine bars because that's not what they want. So I feel like maybe if people were to, say, loosen up a bit, even if it's just once in a while, try something new, you know, create an environment where maybe it's not, you know, from a musician's perspective, a perfect listening environment, but people can feel more relaxed and comfortable, and they would get more out of the music than if they were sitting there terrified of making a mistake. So that would be my argument.
Thank you, Janice. This was a nice roundup, and I'm off to the airport now, leaving Berlin on Sunday morning. It's been really nice talking to you about this flavor connection to music. So thank you so much for being here and sharing this.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And to the listeners, keep following Lyttelos.